This is the Horse Radio Network.
What a beautiful day for horses in the morning.
Well, good Wednesday morning, everybody. I am Glenda Geek from Ocala, Florida.
And I'm Jamie Jennings in Phoenix, Arizona. And you're listening to our special Disney World episode of Horses in the Morning on the Horse Radio Network for October 5th, episode 1535. Good morning, Horse World.
First came the Magic Kingdom, then Epcot, then Disney MGM Studios. And now... Introducing the most adventurous Walt Disney World theme park ever. Disney's Animal Kingdom. The imagination of Disney. Gone wild.
Well, welcome to Animal Kingdom, everybody. This is the second annual Disney World episode. If you missed last year's episode, it was all about the horses at Disney World. You can go to horsesinthemorning.com and search Disney World. It'll bring it up. Today, we will be speaking with many people who help and care for the animals at Animal Kingdom Park and who help their animal outreach programs around the world.
Yeah, the Disney Conservation Fund has awarded more than $40 million in annual grants since it began in 1995. Now, the program helped conserve more than, check this out, they've conserved 400 species around the world and supported the protection of more than 3,600 square miles of habitat. And that is the equivalent, check this out, Glenn. Because you walk around this park. That's 60 Disney World resorts about.
Yeah, that's way too tiring.
I can't even walk through one Disney World a day. So they've also funded education programs that have directly engaged more than 3 million people in conservation efforts. The Disney Conservation Fund, the DCF, also just kicked off a new initiative to help protect the planet by collaborating with leading nonprofit organizations that are going to help threaten wildlife and inspire a lifelong love for nature and young people. The new initiative called Reverse the Decline, Increase the Time is aimed at reversing the decline of 10 threatened species through scientific research, community collaboration, and increasing the time the kids spend in nature.
We have a bunch of guests coming up today from Disney, and we're so excited about all of them. No, I didn't get to hear that music some more today. It'll be stuck in your head for all day long.
I'll keep going. Go ahead.
We have a very special guest to start today, somebody who's a friend of the Horse Radio Network. We met her last year. We spent 2 days with her last year. Her name is Robin Walker. She's zoological manager at Disney's Tri-Circle D Ranch. And good morning, Robin.
Hakuna Matata.
Good morning, Horse World.
Hakuna Matata.
Hakuna Matata. Matata.
Thank you, Robin, for all the help you have put in. You helped us get one of the animators, and that was so fascinating. We loved talking to them. And now you've kind of got this ball rolling and helped us get in touch with the people over at Animal Kingdom, because horse people are lovers of all animals. And we're going to find out about more of those today. But, you know, the horses are still at Tri-Circle D Ranch and gearing up for a busy holiday season.
Yeah, we definitely are. You know, we are so excited here when the holidays come around. Well, every day is a holiday for us, but, you know, we have a lot going on, you know, rolling into the fall and, of course, into the Christmas season. You know, right now we've got Mickey's Not So Scary Halloween parties going on in the Magic Kingdom. And who do you think makes his appearance every year at that party? Who do you think it is?
The Headless Horseman.
The Headless Horse.
I got it.
Headless Horseman.
I'm in a wrong path. I was going to say Mickey.
Well, he does.
Well, of course, Mickey and Minnie and all of his friends are there. But the Headless Horseman comes every year, and the Headless Horseman's horse stays here at the Tri-Circle D Ranch. So you know, we spend the fall getting ready for that. And then, of course, the Christmas season. So we're already in preparations for that, you know, rehearsals for the Christmas shows and the parades. And then here at the ranch, we also have our sleigh rides at Fort Wilderness, which we're really excited about. So we've got a lot to keep us busy.
It is Florida. So are the sleigh rides actually on snow? Does Mickey make snow? How does that work?
Well, Mickey does make snow, but you know, we don't have enough snow necessarily, but they're on wheels. But you know, it's still the magic of Disney World. You know, it feels like winter when you're here. You know, we have the jingle bells on the horses. Everybody here at Fort Wilderness and the campground, they decorate their campsites. So it's kind of like an old-fashioned Christmas. You know, there's hot chocolate being served by the local restaurant here, and it's just a really fun time.
Question for you. When does the holiday stuff kick off? Somebody told me it was right after Halloween was over. Is it closer to Christmas? How does that work?
Well, pretty much it starts, you know, you go through Halloween, and then the sleigh rides pretty much pick up right at the end of November, right after Thanksgiving. So the last weekend in November into December, the whole month of December.
Okay, because Glenn, I haven't even told you this, but I'm going to need some time off because I'm actually going to go to Disney World the 13th and 14th of November.
Oh, you'll be in full holiday swing. You won't have to worry about that. And
good.
And that means we need time off too because we're coming down to join you. So.
Oh, geez. Sounds good. I'm going to be gone that
well. It's my favorite time at Disney, and it's one of the reasons we moved to Florida is so we could go to Disney at Christmas time. I mean, it's just, it is magical, and it doesn't matter what the temperature is. Robin was right about that. It's just a magical place to be all the time, but especially at Christmas.
Robin, yeah, it is, and they'll start decorating right after Halloween.
Yeah, you'll be good. You'll be in full Christmas mode.
You'll be good.
You've got to go do the trail ride, though, and visit Robin over at Tri-Circle D.
Yeah.
She'll set you up over
there. Yeah, you know, we will. We'll hook you up, and you can get out on that trail ride. You know, we have a trail ride that leaves 5 times a day, and, you know, we have people here that wouldn't think to ride anywhere else, and they come here, and they have their first trail ride and introduction to horses right here. You know, we definitely feel like we're an ambassador for the horse world, and then we have the pony rides for the little cowboys and cowgirls who aren't quite old enough to go on the trail ride because they have to be 9 in order to do that.
Well, and gotcha. I rode a Disney horse, and I did not die. So there you go.
Did they put you on the pony rides?
They did. I was on the pony rides. That's right. Okay. Yeah, they didn't trust me on a real horse. So thank you, Robin.
And for those guests who won't get on the trail rides, though, they can do the carriage rides as well.
Which we did too, and that was a lot of fun. Of course, I'm a carriage driver, so I'm partial to that. But it was fun.
Yeah.
Robin, thank you so much. Where can people find out about doing the carriage and the trail rides at Disney? Where do they go?
Well, they can call WDW Play in order to make reservations. They can get on the Walt Disney World website, and there's total information on that. And of course, we have blogs and Facebook pages as well.
Very good.
So
thank you, Robin.
Places that they can find out. And thank you. And I'm very excited that you're going to talk to my friends over at Animal Kingdom.
Well, and thanks for all your help again. We really do appreciate it. I also want to thank Stephanie Shook, who is in communications over there, who helped put all this together. She worked hard on this, and we really appreciate her as well. Take care, Robin. So,
Hakuna Matata.
See you later.
I have the feeling we're going to be hearing that a lot today from Jamie.
What does Hakuna Matata mean?
I don't know. We'll find
out. Means no worries for the rest of your days. Oh, my God. It's something.
You've only watched that movie with your child about 50 times, I'm guessing.
Well, no, we watched The Lion Guard, which is the cartoon spinoff that goes on the Disney Channel.
Ah, gotcha. Well, we have our next guest. We have him lined up today. We're going to go right into Dr. Deidre Fontenot, which I think is how you say it. Over 15 years, along with other members of Disney's animal care team, they've been lending a helping hand on the beautiful Pacific Islands of the Marineras to save multiple species of birds, including the Guam rail.
Marinara Islands. Mariana.
Mariana. Did I say Marinara? I said that the other day, too.
Yeah,
I have spaghetti on the brain. Good morning. How are you?
Hafadai, everyone. My name is Dr. Deidre, and I just said hello and good morning in Chamorro, which is the local language and culture of the people of the Marianas.
Not the Marineras, which apparently is what I have on the brain.
Not the Marineras. Maybe that's an island in Italy.
It could be. That's funny. So what did you say it for us again?
It is Hafa Adai, H-A-F-A-A-D-A-I, which is good morning, similar to aloha for the Micronesian people of the Marianas.
Cool. And of course, if anybody that's not sure where that is probably knows where Guam is, because that would be the one that everybody over here recognizes. So tell us, we're going to talk today about the birds in that island chain, and especially in Guam. So talk to us a little bit about that and what's happening over there.
Well, Disney has been involved in conservation work over there since 2001. So we have a long history, as Walt Disney has has always been committed to conservation. And there was an accidental introduction of a snake. I really don't like stories where snakes are the bad guy, but unfortunately, this is one of those.
You work for Disney. So it was believed snakes are always the bad guys.
That's true. In Disney movies, that's true.
No, we've got a lot of good guys that are snakes around here at Animal Kingdom.
Oh, good.
Anyway, so this is a story where the snake got introduced onto the island. It was believed during a lot of the air traffic of World War II that the snake made it onto the island. And what happened is we had an apex predator that was introduced onto an island that doesn't have apex predators. And what happened is this predator basically ate all of the birds, literally. There were 5 to 7 species that were declared extinct before they were able to rescue 2 species, both of which we have at Animal Kingdom. One is the Guam kingfisher, and the other is the Marianas fruit dove. And then we also work with a small non-flighted bird called the Guam rail. The Chamorro name is the Coco. And we help with the reintroduction program back to get those birds back on Guam. These are species that are unique only to those islands. And so it's important for us to be engaged, but it's also important for the people of the Marianas to know how important, how unique their birds are, and how they have that connection to their culture. And so it's just been a real privilege to be a part of that program.
So what are you doing on the island, on the islands, especially Guam, to alleviate the snake issue? Or, you know, what are you doing to try and preserve the birds? So, because I assume the snakes are still eating the eggs, which is the problem.
They absolutely are. It is quite a multifactorial approach. So we have a lot of organizations that we work with. The USDA manages a lot of the brown tree snake control. They have snake sniffing dogs, believe it or not, that work the airport and other areas looking for those snakes to make sure that the snakes don't make it to other islands. And then they have these unique strategies where they're trying to eliminate the snakes using everything from Tylenol-laced prey items that they're launching into parachutes. It's an unbelievable initiative that they're doing to try to eliminate and control these snakes. Our role is to provide veterinary and husbandry expertise to the team on the island, which is the Department of Aquatic and Wildlife Resources, that not only breed the birds in a snake-proof facility, but also facilitate releases to some of the neighboring islands where they do not have brown tree snakes. So we facilitate that process. We're also translocating birds, which means to move from one island to the other, from an island where we're afraid the brown tree snake is going to make it next. And so what we're doing is we're trapping birds on that high-risk island and moving them to uninhabited islands to build insurance populations, because we don't want what happened on Guam to happen on the other islands. So we're trying to protect the birds that still exist on the other islands.
Now, how do you convince them to stay? Or is the distance too far? Are you building a big wall? Seeing we've been talking about walls lately. How are you convincing them to stay on the island?
And that is a great question. Now, these birds are forest birds. So they tend to not do that. I'm going to fly across the ocean behavior. So they tend to stay within their forest habitats that we release them onto.
Got it. Okay.
And the islands are pretty far apart from each other. Generally, some of them as far as 20 to 25 miles, but some of the island chain are about 2 to 3 miles apart.
Okay. I have a question. When you think of Disney World and, obviously the conservation is something different, but like, how does Disney World get involved with the Mariana Islands? I mean, that just seems like a world away from Orlando.
That is a great question. For us, we actually, through the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, we have different population management programs called Species Survival Plans. And Disney's role began with the Guam Kingfisher, which has a species survival plan. We began our work by breeding those birds in captivity in a managed care situation to eventually contribute to the reintroduction program. Then in working with the team that are part of the reintroduction program, we saw a veterinary support need and offered our services. And then it really just grew from there. So it started as a veterinary initiative, expanded to we teach them about incubating eggs, how to manage birds with training, with enriching them with diet items, nutritional support, and then it expanded from there. We know that conservation and the science of conservation is great to be a part of, but if you're not educating the community, that's a critical piece as well. So then we expanded to doing community outreach. Each time that we're traveling to Guam, we do a community event where we reach out to the children so that they can look for our science and opportunities in conservation, with our hope that we can capacity build on the island so that the people are invested and have that cultural connection and realize how important their forests are, how important watershed is, and protecting your coral reefs and what you're doing on your island can influence the forest, and how important birds are to seed dispersal and all of the different roles that kids can play, because we know that it's the kids who are going to go to their parents and teach them about recycling, about how to build backyard habitats, and those are really the critical piece that we want to reach when we're there on the islands.
Oh my gosh. See, this is you guys have just got a total handle on it. I mean, you get those kids involved and you'll change lives and you'll improve everything forever, as you guys very well know, but that's really inspiring.
Absolutely. And it's a multifactorial approach. And I think that's what Disney does so well, is we can provide expertise, but we also want to support the local people in our process.
So now, at Animal Kingdom, you do have some of these birds, and I know I've seen them. But there's a lot of work that goes on behind the scenes at Animal Kingdom too, with animals that are there but we don't see. Is that right? Where you're helping do the preservation and breeding and things like that?
Absolutely. And the Guam Kingfisher is a great example of that. There's only about 100 in captivity. So we keep them in a controlled breeding environment. They're very territorial. They require these cavity nesting. So they need some very, very specialized care. And so we're able to do that at our avian research and breeding facility.
And what's that like? That must be a cool place.
Oh, it is. It is an absolutely, I call it my Serenity Now space, where I like to go. The birds are chirping. It's beautiful, lush areas. It's a very comfortable place for the birds to be. So very, very cool. And we're hoping that is some contribution in telling the story about those birds in our off-exhibit spaces are a great part of sharing a lot of the great things that Disney does.
All right. Very cool. Well, we're so excited that you guys are doing the work that you're doing. And it is important no matter where it is around the world. And I think one of the fun things we wanted to show today is how much of this work that Disney does do that really gets very little recognition.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I'd love to introduce you guys to Dr. Anne, who
sure.
has just come in.
Okay, cool.
So
cool.
I will say hafadai again, which similar to aloha can mean goodbye. And I really, really enjoyed talking with you guys. And thank you so much for your time.
All right. Thanks a bunch. Hafadai. We're learning all kinds of new words today. Why don't you introduce Dr. Ann while she's getting set up?
All right. We have Dr. Ann Savage on. And Dr. Ann Savage, Dr. Savage, established an on-site conservation program that combines field research, education initiatives, and community programs in Colombia. So now we're just testing your geography knowledge today, Glenn. In Colombia, to raise public awareness on the plight of the cotton-topped tamarin. Now, if you don't know what a cotton-topped tamarin is, Google it because it's the cutest thing ever. And that's kind of one of the problems, I do believe, is they're just too stinking cute. So, Dr. Savage, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us. I know you're just kind of the animal guru down there. And are you living in Florida or are you a Columbia? Do you go back and forth? What's the deal?
Well, I live in Florida, but I do spend a lot of time in the country of Columbia. I call it my second home.
Okay, gotcha. So tell us a little bit about what you do.
So I work with one of the cutest monkeys in the world, the cotton-top tamarin. It's a small 1-pound monkey with this shock of white hair. In fact, it looks like it's got this sort of punk hairdo. And, you know, because of its tiny nature, it's found in the tropical forests of Colombia. And when you hear about issues with tropical forests, you know that there are lots of problems with habitat being destroyed. But as you mentioned, cotton-tops are incredibly cute. So there is this need for people to want them as pets. And so we've been working really, really hard on a couple of different approaches to help local communities understand why it's so important to preserve this little monkey and preserve the habitat that it has. And we do that through some really fun initiatives. You know, we work very closely with our communities in a number of ways. We've got a great program that teaches kids about cotton-top tamarins, because when I first started working with cotton-tops, we surveyed people in the community, and nobody knew that cotton-top tamarins were found only in the country of Colombia and that they were an endangered species. They really thought they were as common as squirrels and that we had them here in the United States. So if we want people to conserve something, we really need to get them to understand why it's so important.
And let them know that it's special and it's their culture and their heritage.
Exactly. And, you know, we started this whole campaign that really positions the cotton top as something very special because it's only found in Colombia and it's 100% Colombian, just like they are. And that's one of the taglines that we use that's really resonated with the people in Colombia.
Why are they only found there?
Well, it's interesting. It has a lot to do with the geography. You know, there's a mountain range and oceans that prevent them from spreading into other countries. So, you know, there are lots of species that are like that. They're found in just particular areas of the world because of different restrictions in habitats. So the interesting thing about cotton tops is that, you know, through our education programs, we've really gotten people to care about them. So we've brought books to communities where kids get to learn about cotton tops. When you go to rural communities in Colombia, kids don't have books when they go to school. The kids, the teachers write on the chalkboard and the children will copy it into a little notebook. What we've done is created a book that allows kids to learn about cotton tops as well as what they can do to help. And this has been something that's been really life-changing in these communities because kids now have a book that they not only learn from, but they take it home and they read to their brothers and sisters and other family members, and now everyone is learning about cotton tops. And it's been this huge impact in really getting the word out there. In addition to that, we've got some other programs where we take some of the brightest and most dedicated kids that are interested in conservation and teach them how to be community leaders. And it's been really fun because these kids get to work on projects where they're either replanting forest stands near their areas or they're developing recycling programs, all in the name of wanting to protect cotton tops. And when you go into these communities, we've been able to blend a lot of music and art into this work as well. So you'll go into communities and see sides of buildings painted with cotton top tamarins and messages about why we want to protect them. And kids are now creating songs about cotton tops and dances about cotton tops. In fact, they've even created a holiday in Colombia called the Day of the Cotton Top, which is August 15th, where all communities come together and celebrate their commitment.
Oh, that's
cool.
But
our newest program that's been really, really fun is, you know, we're trying to get people to understand why cotton tops should be left in the forest and not kept as pets. And so when you think about what really makes a good pet, it's really domestic animals. But kids in Colombia, really, they don't have a great relationship with domestic animals. You know, most people have dogs in their communities because it alerts them when strangers come to their property. And so, and they really don't think dogs are very bright. So what we've done is taken the expertise that we have here at Disney's Animal Kingdom with some of our amazing animal keepers, and we've started a program where we teach kids how to train their dogs to do simple behaviors. And this has been really remarkable because all of a sudden, these kids now have pets that are really interested in bonding with them.
And they're teaching their dogs to sit, to roll over, and it's been remarkable because now kids want to have a dog as a pet instead of a monkey.
Mm. Oh, so that's how you tie it in. I was like, what does this have to do with the cotton tufts? But that's genius. I mean, you've kind of like, I mean, this is like mind control. It's awesome. You've gone, hey, here we go. These are very native for you, and they're very special, and you shouldn't touch them. But here, let me give you a puppy.
Exactly. And now, you know, when the great thing about it is when you tell people, hey, please don't do this, and you give them something else in return, they're like, absolutely, I get why I need to save cotton tops. And now, guess what? I'm going to have this great relationship with my dog and even have a better life for my dog because now the dogs are getting well cared for. And you should see these kids walking around with their dogs now. It's so cute. And they want to do dog shows and, you know, all of this really fun stuff.
How long has this been going on? I'm sorry, just how long has this program been going on? Because I know that there's fewer than 7,000 cotton tops left in the wild. So, I mean, is this a newer initiative?
No, it's actually been going on for quite some time. It actually started when I was a graduate student many years ago, but it's really, really blossomed in probably like the last 10 years. And I'm really happy to say that we've done some census work. And, you know, while there was 7,000 was our original estimate about 7 years ago, we went back and did another survey to see how many cotton tops were left. And they're still at 7,000. So when you think about all the things that are happening in today's world, the fact that the population is holding stable is a huge victory for cotton top tamarins.
Absolutely. What are they difficult to breed? Are there predators that take them? What else are some of the threats that they face? And then how can people help?
Well, one of the other great programs that we have is a program to help a lot of local communities who really don't have a way to have a stable source of income. You know, there's very few jobs in rural communities in Colombia. And so a lot of these folks then end up going into the forest to cut down trees to sell, or they're hunting animals to eat. So what we've done is created a program for local artisans where we've trained them how to crochet, not using cotton, but plastic bags. And so we have a big recycling program where we collect plastic bags before they go into the waste stream, and our artisans make these beautiful tote bags that are called eco mochilas. And you can buy these eco mochilas at Disney's Animal Kingdom or online at preactivett.com. And it's a great way to help support these local communities. And this has really been able to revolutionize how we've been able to really engage communities, because by creating jobs and by educating folks, they really understand the need and they want to do this. You know, it's when you talk to people in Colombia now, there's such pride around saying, you know what, we are helping to reverse the decline of cotton top tamarins in our country, and it's all through the efforts of the work that we do. And so they are so proud of it. And, you know, there was recently one of the Colombia made a new movie about wildlife, and they featured cotton top tamarins as one of their species. So that wouldn't have happened probably 10 or 15 years ago.
Well, and I think you guys have made it to where almost if you know somebody that is keeping a cotton top tamarin as a pet, it's almost like you get to shame them. You know, like,
exactly.
This is ours. This is our country's. Go ahead. Sorry.
Absolutely. And when we first started working in Colombia, there were a lot of people that had them as pets. And I'm happy to tell you now that the communities where we work, nobody has a cotton top as a pet. And they are very proud of that fact.
Really? That's awesome.
And they must want them as pets. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about their personalities. They must want them as pets because they're personable.
Well, you know, they're incredibly cute. And when they're little, they, you know, like to be around people, and they will cling to you. They have some amazing vocalizations. They have about 40 different calls that they give. And the other thing that's really cool about cotton tops is that they generally always give birth to twins. Huh. So there's nothing more exciting than looking up in the trees and seeing those two little heads looking at you.
Are they out and about right away, or do they hang out in a nest for a while, or are they in the trees doing their thing immediately?
They're in the trees with their parents. So one of the things that's cool about cotton tops is that it's not just mom who takes care of the babies. It's mom, dad, brothers, and sisters all carry the babies on their backs. Hmm. And they are dependent on their parents for about the first 12 weeks of life. And then they'll start to slowly get off and explore the forest. And they learn what to eat by stealing food from their parents. And it's really neat because the parents have a food chirp that says, I have food in my hand. And when the babies hear that, they just come run and steal the food.
That's so cool.
Now, Glenn, if you haven't seen these, imagine that put your hands together like you're cupping something. Two hands. And the cotton top tamer would fit in your hand. However, when I think of like good pets, I can't imagine these are great pets because they are fast. They're bing, 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 bing. I mean, they're just everywhere all the time. They're so quick. I can't imagine one snuggling up with somebody. It can't be how they behave as pets. It must have to keep them pretty locked up, huh?
Yeah, when they're tiny babies, then they're really cuddly and cute. But once puberty hits, it's sort of all over, and then they end up having to put them in a cage.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then it's just tough. And then that well, I'm so proud of what you guys have done and getting the kids involved and making it to where it's just genius, you know, make it to where like, you're hurting yourself because it's your own country and this is your pride involved. And that was really, really a great way to go about it. I'm excited. And what is the website people can go to check out more about the cotton top tamarins?
ProyectoTT.com, or you can learn more about it at DisneyAnimals.com.
And we're going to put a link in our Facebook page too to ProyectoTT.com because it's hard to spell. So we'll put a link to it in our Facebook page and our show notes. But Dr. Ann, she's busy down there. She also works on a project at Disney World that involves the largest swallow in North America, the Purple Martins.
Yeah, and she's our next guest, actually.
I know, she's right here. And apparently they have bought season tickets, the Purple Martins, to Disney World. And stop over and enjoy the resorts and the food and apparently get a little frisky while they're there, like a lot of other people do at Disney World. And you're going to talk to us a little bit about the Purple Martins.
I know. Purple Martins are one of my favorite birds. You know, they fly from one of the most remote places on Earth, a tiny little island in the Brazilian Amazon in the middle of nowhere. And they fly 3,000 miles to Walt Disney World, one of the most happiest places on Earth, to raise their family. How cool is that?
So I thought it was funny that they do stop by Disney World. We live in Ocala, so we go there all the time. And, of course, we're familiar with swallows. As horse people, we all have barn swallows. So what makes the Purple Martin different than the barn swallow that we try and keep out of our barn because they make a mess?
Well, Purple Martins are a little bit different in that they are colonial nesters. So they have, they're completely dependent upon people to put up nest colonies for them.
Oh.
And years ago, Native Americans used to put up gourds around their crops because Purple Martins will eat insects. They're aerial insectivores. So when you think about those big, tasty dragonflies, those are one of the things they love to eat. So now Purple Martins are completely dependent upon people to put up these houses, and we have a bunch of houses at Walt Disney World. You can see them at Epcot, at Caribbean Beach Resort, at Saratoga Springs, and even back here at Disney's Animal Kingdom.
Are they the white, bubbly-looking things?
Exactly.
Okay.
That's it.
Now I know exactly because it took us a long time. We would drive in and you'd see them along the roads there too, and then we'd also see them out and about, and we were going, what the heck are those? So that's what they are.
Exactly. So we expect Purple Martins to start arriving around January. We typically see the first eggs appearing around St. Patrick's Day in March. And then come July or so, we bid them a fond farewell as they head back to Brazil.
So this is the furthest north they come then?
Well, they actually will nest all the way into Canada.
Oh, wow.
But our colony tends to be the first that arrive. The Florida colonies start first, and the Canada colonies end up arriving usually in April, May, June.
And they don't have to pay for parking, right?
No, they don't.
Just checking.
You never know.
Matter of fact, they get prime parking. They get their own house at Disney World. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. But it's amazing to think that this little 2-ounce bird makes a 6,000-mile round trip every year to come to Walt Disney
World. And we need GPS. Jamie's husband is a airline pilot and a fighter pilot. He needs GPS to find that location. They have these teeny-weeny little brains that do that. It's amazing.
It is. It's so amazing. Not only do they come back to their same nesting location, but a lot of times they'll choose the exact same place where they nested the previous year. But I'm here to tell you, they don't always choose the same mate.
Ah, okay.
Oh, the little monsters.
They're naughty. They are naughty at Disney World. So what are they? Do they eat berries? Are they eating worms? What do they eat?
No, they eat primarily insects.
Okay,
those big flying insects are what they really love.
Okay, cool. Very cool.
My father-in-law, now this makes sense. He's got, I like to say, a purple martin habitat. I mean, he just has all these white birdhouse type things, but they're like condominiums almost.
Like igloos, and, right? Igloos, yeah.
No. This is a giant birdhouse with all these different holes, and it looks like apartment. A big, giant condominium, like an apartment, yeah. And it is on a very, very, very tall stick, and he always constantly worries when they get weather in Oklahoma that it's gonna, that they're all gonna blow over. But they're purple martin houses, so purple martins go all the way to Oklahoma. So is it not just Florida that they live in? Are they all over the country?
They're primarily in the East Coast and parts of the Midwest.
Oh, that makes sense then. Yeah.
Okay, so how far north do they go?
They can go into Canada, all the way to Canada.
Oh my gosh.
How long does a bird live? Is that a stupid question? But I have no idea the length of time that a bird lives.
I think it depends a lot on the different things that it faces. We've had birds return up to 4 years. So imagine they were hatched here at Walt Disney World and have come back, made that migratory flight 4 times. So when they don't return, we don't really know what happens to them. They may have either chosen a nest somewhere else around Florida, or they may just not have made it back. But 4 years for a bird that flies that far is pretty remarkable.
That's a lot of frequent flyer miles there. Well,
exactly.
Dr. Ann Savage, thank you so much for joining us and telling us about the tamarins and also the purple martins. We really appreciate it. And am I correct in that you're handing the phone off again?
I am indeed. I'm going to be passing it to Rachel Denault, who's here to talk to you about the wonderful work that's going on to help protect gorillas in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Cool.
My gosh, we've been all over the world. Now we're going to head to the Republic of the Congo. So listen, this one is something I'm really excited to hear about, because there's just nothing kind of more magical than the gorillas, if you've ever seen Gorillas in the Mist or any of the work that's been done for gorillas. And I'm so excited to hear that they're saving gorillas, and it's all tied to Disney World. So Rachel Denault is the primate zoological manager for Disney's Animal Kingdom and joins us to speak about GRACE, which is a program to provide the best facilities and care for rescued, is it Grayers gorillas in the Democratic Republic of Congo, while working alongside local communities to ensure gorilla survival in the wild. Good morning, Rachel.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you. Do you have the coolest job in the animal kingdom? I mean, did you win the lottery of like employees? What happened?
Well, it's pretty funny. I did not set out to work with primates even at all. And about 15 years ago, a little over 15 years ago, started working with gorillas, and something just clicked. And I have since gone on to be the chair of our Gorilla Behavioral Advisory Group for North America and work with the species survival programs for North American gorillas. So I was very lucky when Disney started getting involved with GRACE.
Okay, hold up. One does not just start working with gorillas, so I need a little background.
Well, I actually, my background was with mixed species. I also, my favorite was red pandas. Loved red pandas.
Oh.
But what I really enjoyed was the behavioral aspects of our job. So watching the animals, learning about why they do things, training with the animals. Mm-hmm. And the primate team here at Disney was very well known for the program, and they had an opening. So I decided, even though primates were not really my favorite, their training and behavioral program was beyond compare. So I applied for the job and I got it and I got hooked.
Okay. What is the, when we've got people listening that are in college right now, what is the major that they have to get to work with you? What did you go to school for? So,
I actually have a degree in zoology. So zoology would be one, biology, psychology, in particular for primates, anthropology. There's a lot of degrees out there now that you can use. The biggest thing, though, to get into the field that I do is you do a lot of volunteer work and a lot of interning. So I did what I do now for 2 years for free.
Yeah,
I pretty much means that you pick up poop for like 2 years.
For free.
We know what interning exactly in the horse world means. It means grab a pitchfork and go to the barn. That's what interning in the horse world
means. It means the same thing here. So definitely it is a career where you love what you do and you have passion for what you do. And you're not really into it for the glamour or the money.
You know, I've gotten a question a number of times today. I'm getting questions from listeners on Facebook here. And that was the number one question, is how do you get to work with the animals at Disney? And I think you've just answered it. I think that's the answer. Tell us what GRACE is. And it's G-R-A-C-E.
It is. And so that stands for the Gorilla Rehabilitation and Conservation Education Center. You guys have already mentioned it is in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And it is the only orphanage for Growler's gorillas in the world. So what we do is we take in orphaned gorillas from poachers, and we help provide them the most natural life possible given their situation. So it became apparent to us around 2008 that poaching was a huge issue and there was a market for these orphaned gorillas. And when law enforcement was going in and trying to enforce and prevent this from happening, the biggest problem was there was nowhere for these orphans to go. So it came to our attention and we decided to create GRACE.
Okay. Why on earth would somebody, this might be a dumb question, but why on earth would somebody shoot an adult gorilla? What do they get out of it?
Actually, it's not a dumb question. It's actually one that is really, at this point, creating a drastic drop in the population size, and that's for something called bushmeat. They basically eat them. So what's happening is these people are going deep into the forest, and primarily what we're finding is that they are mining. Most people don't realize that in DRC, they have trillions of dollars of untapped ore there. And there's really no infrastructure. There's no legislation. So people go deep into the woods. They start these illegal mining groups, and they have to eat, and this is where the gorillas live. So they can go, and what they will do is they will kill an entire group of gorillas, and they'll sell the meat. They'll eat the meat, and they'll sell the meat. Then the orphans, they are trading in the black market. So they are selling them for pets, basically, on the black market, and they're getting quite a substantial amount for these infants. So it unfortunately has become more prevalent recently.
How do you not just hate all people?
Well, one of the things is when you go to GRACE and you see the community and the support that we are given to help save these animals and to hopefully potentially reintroduce these orphaned gorillas back into the wild, then you understand, because these are people who are just trying to survive and they want an alternative solution. So one of the things that's so wonderful about GRACE is that we really look for opportunities not only to help the gorillas but help the community. So we look at education opportunities for the folks around there to learn why they should help these animals and ways that they can obtain food without going into the forest for bushmeat. So it's when you go over there and you see how committed these people are to saving these animals, it's extremely inspiring. And, you know, the story of GRACE is really cool because the people came to us and said, "We want to help these animals. We will give you our land if you will help us build this and do this." Because they knew they didn't have the expertise to do it, but they have the place. They have the animals. And, you know, when a community comes to you and asks you to help them like that, you just don't say no.
Tell us about gorilla biscuits. I read an article about that. Yeah, I thought it was fun.
So this is one of my favorite stories, and it just goes to show how it does take a village and how we want to help that community. So our nutritionist here at Disney, Shannon Livingston, what she did was she worked with some of the caregivers at Grace, and she asked them to send a list of different food items available locally in the community. This is a very remote community, so they don't have a lot of things they can get easily. And they sent her a list of items, and so what she did is she started making biscuit recipes, gorilla biscuit recipes. And she tried several different formulations, and it was really fun because we actually tested them out for palatability with our gorillas here. And our gorillas would try them and let us know, hey, is this a good recipe, or do we need to tweak it? And from there, we were able to send these recipes to the folks up at Grace. They are able to source the ingredients locally in the local market, so therefore kind of creating a little bit of an economy there. And they make these biscuits now. And these biscuits really were needed for nutrition. These gorillas definitely have had early childhood issues as far as nutrition goes. Most of them were not given good nutrition during their time with poachers, which was extended for some of them. And so we've found that we need to provide them a little something extra other than just the things we're able to procure from the forest. So these biscuits are going to do that for those animals. And so, again, you can see that how it's full circle, helping the community, helping the caregivers take care of the animals, giving the animals the best health and nutrition possible.
Rachel, be honest. Did they like the chocolate-covered ones better?
I'll be honest. I tried them.
Of course you did. Any good horse chick eats a horse food. So a gorilla woman's got to be just as crazy.
Absolutely.
That's funny.
So how can people, I'm really, really interested in gorillas. I love them very much, and I would like to help. What can I do to help save the Growers Gorillas? Is it Grayers Gorillas? Sorry.
It's Growers Gorillas.
Growers Gorillas. Okay, yeah. The Growers Gorillas are the ones that you guys are helping. And what can I do as just a normal, everyday person listening to this show, which I am, by the way.
So, well, since Grace is the only orphanage for Growers Gorillas, one of the first things I would suggest is go to our website, gracegorillas.org. That has a ton of information about what's going on in the field there, as well as the animals that are at Grace. And it'll give you some of that information about what's going on in the country. A study just came out this year. And in the past 20 years, we've lost 77% of that population. What most people don't realize is these animals only live in DRC. They are considered one of the 25 most endangered primates in the world. They are considered critically endangered. So these are all opportunities to educate yourself about what is going on with them. And then also looking at what's going on in that country. So buying sustainable items, you know, you hear about conflict-free diamonds, conflict-free minerals, recycling your cell phones. All of these are things that are going to help improve conditions in the country and therefore conditions for the animals.
Absolutely. Now, I would like to introduce you to Dr. Savage, because what they did is they went over and talked to the kids. So are you engaging the kids in the DRC?
Absolutely. So community education is key. You know, although the people did come to us, they still need to learn ways for sustainability within their communities. Plus, the children really are the key. We find that if we do the education with the kids, then the kids go home and educate the parents. And so at Grace, we have actually started a community education program where the kids get to come up to Grace. They are taught about gorillas, and then they get to go up onto a platform and see our gorillas. And this is probably the first time any of them have ever seen a gorilla, really in any context. And we've found that it seems to be a pretty meaningful event for them. Because most Congolese people have never seen a gorilla. These, especially Gorauer's gorillas, tend to be very elusive. And so you hear stories sometimes from some of the senior people in the communities, but most people that are still alive in there have never even seen a gorilla. So we find that the education piece and then really, you know, getting to see a live gorilla is hugely impactful.
Gosh, that's cool. That's great. That's great. Education breeds interest. And what that does is it sets up those kids for the rest of their life. And maybe they'll be one of the people that says, back, you know, further on down the road, they're in the middle of the jungle and somebody's like, let's shoot them. And they're like, no, don't shoot them. So you're setting up such a, you know, a great uphill incline, I think, for saving the gorillas. And it's just so incredibly important. And I do want to thank you so much, Rachel, for coming on. It's gracegorillas.org. And again, this is all through Disney World. It's just absolutely incredible. Yes. Disney's Animal Kingdom. So thank you for what you do. And thanks for helping the animals. And thanks for coming on our show.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, and understand too, it's not just Disney, it's all zoos around the world who are helping support these projects. So it's a very big community, hopefully saving the world.
Absolutely. And I'm happy about it. So thank you for joining us. And we will talk to you hopefully again soon when you're like, there's no more gorillas getting shot. It's incredible.
That would be awesome.
We've saved.
I would love to give you a population update.
Please do.
Thanks a bunch.
Thank you.
Bye bye.
And we're going to our next guest immediately. We have Dr. Joseph Soltis on here. He is a senior scientist at Disney's Animal Kingdom and leads their bioacoustic laboratory.
This is some science, dude.
I know. We're
getting
deep today. This is fun.
You out right now.
He's teamed up with Dr. King in the Elephants and Bees Project in 2008 to help explore elephant vocal responses to bees and other threats in the environment. So we're really talking about another animal that everybody's familiar with, just like the gorillas and over in that same part of the world, and how we can preserve them as well. Joseph, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
You know, I was reading about your project today. First of all, we've all seen the elephant and the mouse thing, right? I mean, we've all seen that cartoon, and who knew that elephants were afraid of bees? I that just blew my mind. It's like, really?
Yeah, it's a crazy thing. Like, I didn't When they first sort of proposed the project, you know, when I got into it, they had already sort of discovered that elephants were afraid of bees, and I was like, how would you even think of that idea?
They have tough skin, right? Don't they? I mean, when a bee stings an elephant, you wouldn't even think they would feel it.
It hurts.
You know, that's true. For an adult elephant, for most of their body, they have thick skin, everything's fine, but everyone's got sensitive bits on the eyes, in the ears, in the nose, in the mouth, and little babies might be a little bit more sensitive, so the bees can get in there and hurt you.
Ah, got it. Okay, so explain this project. It's fascinating.
Well, a good place to start might be with the sort of the problem. You know, in at least where I work in Kenya and a lot of places in East Africa, the elephants roam free. They're not fenced in the parks, and so they sort of move in and out of the reserve, and that means they move into where people are at, especially the people that sort of have farms, you know, right near the crops. I mean, right near the parks. And these farms, they're just wonderful for elephants because they're herbivores. And so it's like a big salad for them. So they naturally will go into the farms and crop raid. And it can turn out pretty bad because the people, you know, they're just local farmers. They're just trying to make a living. They have to protect themselves and their family. And so it can lead to human-elephant conflict. And sometimes it could even lead to mortality. So we want to find ways to stop elephants from going into these farms. And allow the farmers to, you know, raise their crops and feed their families, but in a nonviolent way. And it turns out that elephants are afraid of bees. And so the Save the Elephants group that I work with, you know, they thought, you know, since elephants are afraid of bees, maybe, just maybe we can fashion some kind of, you know, bee deterrent that will keep elephants from farmers' crops. And they started building beehive fences.
And they're good for what the crops need anyway, and that's pollination. So it's kind of a win-win-win plus honey, right?
Well, I guess it's a win-win-win situation because of the pollination and the honey. So the farmers become, you know, beekeepers, not amateur beekeepers, but, you know, professional beekeepers. And so they can sell the honey or consume it themselves. And so it's really a double whammy. So you keep the elephants out and you get the and you make a profit from your beehive fence. It's like a living fence.
Now you're in a bioacoustic laboratory, of course, dealing with sound. And so how far can an elephant hear a bee? Is that a dumb question? You know what I'm asking?
That's a good question. The bees are high pitched sounds, and they don't travel as far, so they probably don't recognize that there's bees there until they're pretty close, you know, maybe okay. 50 or 25 meters. I'm guessing at that a little bit, just because I know about sound, so it's a little bit theoretical. We haven't tested it. But in terms of their vocalizations, the vocalizations that elephants make, called rumbles, they're really low-frequency, deep sounds, and they can travel for miles, and elephants can hear each other for miles away. And in fact, we discovered through our experiments that elephants produce a special rumble in response to bees, and it's a bee alarm call. So when other elephants hear this rumble, this special rumble, even if bees aren't around, they recognize it. Oh, there must be bees around here, and they run away and shake their heads to get bees off, even though there's no bees present.
Oh, wow. Who knew? It's like their own little Facebook. Bees, bug out.
It absolutely is. It's like, warning, bees, there's bees around here. And we thought, that's pretty cool. And so we thought, I wonder if they have sort of a vocabulary.
Yeah,
they have a word for bees, perhaps. So we played them human voices from a local tribe, and it turns out they have a different rumble, a different word, if you will, for humans. So they can say both bees beware and humans beware.
Wow. So do they? Were you able to determine how many words or signals that they can give?
So far, we just have those two.
Okay.
But there's other threats that elephants face. One would be lions. So.
Right.
When we get a chance, we're kind of busy, but when we get a chance, we'd like to do the same experiments with lions to see if they have a third alarm call.
Oh, that's so cool.
And gosh, that is just incredible. My mind is blown.
That's really neat. Now, is it working? So there's the bottom line, right? Is the Elephants and Bees Project working? Are the crops being preserved, and is there less conflict in the places that they're doing that?
Yeah, that's the thing. We did our experiments. You know, they ran away from bees. They produced an alarm call to maybe even scare other elephants away. But boy, the proof is when we put the beehive fences up. And, I was a little skeptical whether it would totally work because, there's food in there and maybe they'll just bash through the beehive fence. But you know what? They didn't. In the latest study, which is 3 years long, by Tsavo National Park, Lucy King had the farmers and other interns and people sort of using camera traps. And they just sort of looked at the whole environment around these farms, and they could see or learn whenever elephants came in. And out of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times that elephants came in nearby these farms, 80% of the time they were deterred from entering farms, and only 20% of the time did they break through the fence.
Wow.
So that's a pretty good. I was hoping for 50-50, but we got 80%.
And probably those 20%, they're being run. They're running from something, and nothing's going to stop them at that point.
Yeah, or the fence was damaged or something. They went around, but we still counted it as getting through. It was really a minority of cases that they got through the fence. They would usually move along and go to a farm that was unprotected.
One other question before we have to leave here. We have so many guests today. I wish I could talk to you all for longer. So what exactly do you do in the bioacoustic laboratory? I'm fascinated by that for some reason.
Well, it all started when I first got here was working with our elephants here, the herd that we have here at Disney's Animal Kingdom. And we put these collars around the elephants' necks that they wear voluntarily, and we had all kinds of gadgets in them, GPS and a microphone that recorded their vocalizations. And so the way it worked is we learned a lot about elephant vocal communication here, where it's easy to study them, easier than in the wild, learned a lot about what they were doing. And then I met Ian Douglas Hamilton, who's the founder of Save the Elephants. He came here for a visit where he got a conservation award because he really is a conservation hero. And we started talking. So when their research moved to a bioacoustic side and they wanted to determine if elephants had alarm calls, Lucy King sent me an email and invited me to go to Kenya. That was a number of years ago, and I've been going ever since.
Well, that's cool. And Lucy, let's give her some love. I read a couple articles on her today and was just fascinated. Talk about a selfless human being. She really is kind of on the forefront over there.
She really is awesome. This is, Disney is just a partner. a key partner, but a partner in that. Lucy King, she did this whole thing as part of her PhD for Oxford. I've been working with her since then. And boy, she's grown the Elephants and Bees project to like a project of its own. It's still under the umbrella of Save the Elephants. But yeah, she is just awesome. So if you, anyone who's listening, just Google elephants and bees. We're the only people in the whole wide world that use those two words in the same sentence. So you'll easily find her website.
That is true. I Googled it today and it came right up to the top. It's elephantsandbees.com. Well, thank you, Dr. Soltis. We really appreciate you joining us. And of course, you know, elephants, we all know the other problems they have with the poaching and everything going on over there. And we're hoping that there's 1,000 more projects like this helping save the elephants in all over the world, for that matter, not just in Africa.
There are, and we'll continue to work on it.
All right, good. Thank you, Dr. Soltis, for the work you do.
Thank you.
Well, we're going to take a break for a commercial right now.
Just feel
now.
Like you're not doing enough to change the world.
I know. I'm kind of feeling like a schmuck right now, to be honest.
hey, we
talk on the radio. We have a good time every morning, and I'm feeling like a lazy schmuck, to be honest with you, at this point.
Save the world, Glenn. Do something more.
Well, we are, and that's why we're doing this program today. We're helping get the word out about all these terrific projects and all the work that Disney World's doing that people may not be familiar with. But you know what? Ovation sells terrific products, so let's hear from them. Companies like them are what makes our show possible. And we're coming back. We're going to be talking more. We're going to be talking about butterflies yet to come. We're also going to be talking about sea turtles, and we also are going to be talking about Matthew. It's a new animal, a very big one, that's heading for Florida right now.
Horse people know that they can count on Ovation's value, quality, and style when it comes to hard-wearing schooling attire, affordable show gear for horse and rider, or top-of-the-line equipment for riders at every level. From breeches to bridle work, saddles to stock ties, helmets to half-chaps, Ovation is the premier brand of riding apparel and equipment for you and your horse in the United States, outfitting riders at every level from head to toe. Ask for Ovation brand riding helmets, breeches, and footwear at your local tack store, or go online to ovationriding.com and see the fantastic variety of quality, fashion-forward, affordable products from Ovation. ovationriding.com.
And we thank Ovation for their continued support of Horses in the Morning. And you can find all of their products. The holidays are coming, so check them out. They have all kinds of good specials going on right now over on their Facebook page. It'll talk to you about some of the things that are coming up, too, for the holiday season with Ovation products. And, of course, you can find the store list at their website as well, online and for your local tack shops. We are Horses in the Morning. Jamie Jennings here. Coach Jen is in the producer chair. And I'm Glenn the Geek, and we're bringing you the second annual Disney World episode here on Horses in the Morning. Last year, we did it on all of the horses over there at Disney World, and that was a lot of fun. And this year, we're talking about the conservation efforts for different animals from around the world, because all horse people are animal people. And we wouldn't have horses unless we were true animal people. And that's why we thought that this would be a good project for today. We want to wish our best, and our thoughts and prayers. We live in Ocala. We don't have the problem quite as bad. We will get the hurricane, but we have hosts and we have a lot of listeners and fellow horse people that are along the coast in Florida that are evacuating, in Georgia and the Carolinas. I saw a lot of our listeners and auditors have already taken their horses and gotten out and are going back for more horses. Apparently, there are traffic jams on 95 and 75, and one person said that they were heading back to get more horses, and they saw a steady stream of horse trailers heading from the coast inland. So we hope that you all are safe, and that if you do live along the coast, that you heed the warnings. I was heartened this morning to see the Facebook posts of everybody that is getting out with their animals and that have an evacuation plan. So we wish you all the best. I know that Emily was on here from the Jumping Show yesterday, and she lives in Wellington. She's working on her plans right now with her 15 horses, because Wellington is basically built in the Everglades and they just filled it in. If they get a lot of rain, they're going to have a problem there as well. So everybody down there is working on it too. So we wish them all the best. Our thoughts and prayers are with you. And if we're not here on Friday, it means we lost our power again like we did in the last hurricane that went through a month ago. So just wanted to warn you of that as well. Our next guest coming up here to continue with our Animal Kingdom show is Dr. Zach Gazan. He is a conservation program manager for the Disney, working to create butterfly habitats around the world and engage kids and families with nature. In collaboration with the University of Florida, he is making strides to help save butterflies of Florida and California through habitat creation, population monitoring, breeding efforts, and education programs. And I got to tell you, Zach, Jennifer and I live in Ocala, and twice a year we go to the University of Florida in Gainesville, and we see the best butterfly habitat in the world. It is so much fun. We go just for that.
It's phenomenal, isn't it? Good morning. How are you guys doing?
Good. It is. It's phenomenal. It is the coolest place, Jamie. When you come to visit us in Ocala next time, we're going to this butterfly habitat because it is so cool. It is the best one out there.
Yeah, they've got dozens of species flying around, tons of them. You can see them feeding. They've got really cool ones. They've got ones from all over the world. They've got ones from Asia, massive swallowtails that will come down and drink, you know, banana juice, and the blue morphos and the owl butterflies from the Neotropics. They've got a whole bunch of species that are from right here in Florida. That is a phenomenal place to go see butterflies and learn about them.
Now, I did seem like I was wearing a color. I think it was blue that day, and I had more butterflies landing on me than anybody else. Is it color-driven that they're attracted to, or is it just that I stink the right way? I wasn't sure.
It might be a combination of both. Okay. So butterflies have a great sense of smell, and they taste with their feet. And so if you're really sweaty, sometimes butterflies will come and land on you and start lapping up your sweat because they like the salts. They're certainly attracted to some perfumes. And a lot of those butterflies, they really like color. So, you know, like those giant blue morpho butterflies, just like the giant, beautiful butterflies of the Neotropics. If you're wearing like a bright blue parka or something like that, those guys will be all over you. And it's mostly the males that chase the females. So if you're wearing a bright blue parka and you're walking through one of those butterfly gardens, expect male blue morpho butterflies just to be dive bombing you.
And that's what I was getting, actually. I didn't know they were. Yeah. I didn't know they thought I was hot, though. That's a whole new story.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You're kind of thrown for a loop. But that's all right.
You've never been wanted more, Glenn. Okay?
I know.
They wanted to breed with you.
That never happened in high school, by the way.
If you really want to bump it up a notch. So those butterflies are attracted to fermenting fruit. And so if you go into a butterfly garden, like where they have blue morpho butterflies with a glass of wine or something like that, they will absolutely be going nuts for you. And in fact, they'll fly right down and land inside of your glass.
So when I go there the next time, I can tell the guards at the gate that you told me to bring the wine.
No, heaven forbid, no way. You got to be careful. You got to have one of those like German beer steins that covers up the top. Otherwise, they'll be waiting right inside
your glass. I need a flask. So tell me, why are butterflies so important? Let's start there.
So butterflies are, there's two big things with butterflies, and it's such a great combination. So for one thing, they're just absolutely beautiful. They're such a good introduction to insects and other animals. So, you know, insects make up like 80% of species on the planet, but, you know, sometimes they're kind of creepy and gross, and they bite and they sting, and, you know, they're not seen as, you know, if you go to wildlife sanctuaries, if you go to Yellowstone or whatever, and you want to see the wildlife, people don't typically think of as insects as being part of, you know, that suite of species, but they absolutely are. In fact, they make up the bulk of biodiversity, but you know, people don't like them that much. And butterflies are a very approachable insect. And so they're a phenomenal ambassador for biodiversity at large. And they're a really good way to get kids and families in nature and experiencing nature and appreciating the, you know, the bulk of the species out there. And the other thing is, as they're very, very important to supporting ecosystems through pollination. So butterflies like to drink nectar. As they go to flowering plants and they stand on top of the flower and they're drinking the nectar, pollen will get stuck to their body. And then as they go to the next pit stop and they get more nectar, some of that pollen will accidentally get transferred onto another plant. And that's the way that plants reproduce. Like 90% of flowering plants require bees and butterflies and other insects to transport the pollen around for them to help in their reproduction. So butterflies and other pollinators are just simply critical to ecosystems as we know it. So butterflies are just this phenomenal combination of being beautiful, approachable, recognizable, and really, really important for biodiversity.
They have one big negative, though, Jamie, and that's their lifespan is about, what, 14 days?
Yeah, I mean, that seems short from our point of view. But hold on, you gotta realize that's only 14 days as an adult butterfly, right? And there's a whole crazy story that's happening before that, right? So they start off as an egg that's laid on a particular species of plant, and each species of butterfly. So like Florida has almost 200 species of butterflies, right? Every single one of those species of butterflies can usually only lay their eggs on just like one or two or a few species of plant, right? And that's one of the reasons.
Oh, so they're picky about their breeding habitat then.
They're super picky and kind of like we are, you know, like if you walk out into the forest, if you go out into, you know, ride your horse out into the forest of Ocala and you're looking around, how many species of plants looking around do you think you're going to be able to eat?
Yeah, very few.
Like none.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, there's very, very few. We're picking.
Now, our horses are going to try and eat them all, which is bad. But
Right. Well, if they can stomach it, you know, more power to them. But butterflies are more like people in that we're very, very picky eaters. So for all of those species of butterflies, you know, they only have a particular host plant. But you get that that egg laid on there, and it'll be an egg for, you know, 5 to 10 days. That hatches out as this tiny, tiny little caterpillar, just an itsy-bitsy little thing that'll grow and grow to eat its own body weight every day for like a month, just getting more and more massive. They grow so fast, it would be like me deciding I wanted to eat Rice Krispie Treats today and grow my own body weight every single day, and after a month or so, I'd be like bigger than a blue whale. Just explosive growth. It's just bonkers. And then they turn into the chrysalis, and they sit like that for a couple of weeks while they rearrange themselves into a totally different animal, and then they emerge as a butterfly, and as you say, they fly around for about 14 days. But man, their overall lifespan is way longer than that.
And is it true that the cast members are helping you out at Disney World?
Yeah, so one of my primary goals here is I want to make Walt Disney World as butterfly friendly as possible. So we're doing our part to make sure we have lots of plants around to support habitat. In some parts of the state, you know, there are species of butterflies that are really in decline, and we're breeding butterflies and doing habitat restoration and releasing those butterflies into the habitat. And at Disney World, particularly here at Animal Kingdom, we have so many passionate people that really want to be involved with the conservation efforts. But, you know, it's tough. You know, we all want to, but it's tough to find the time of day to go out and do it. So as part of one of the projects that we're doing, where we're doing habitat restoration and breeding species for release, we're in the process of developing a program where cast members can help us raise the insects right in their work area, and then those will be transported out and released by kids back into a restored habitat. So it's a really cool way to get the cast directly involved with one of our broader conservation efforts. It's awesome. It's
I so want cool. a butterfly terrarium in my studio. That'd
you
be
can
cool.
do it. You
That'd
can do
cool.
it.
That'd
yeah,
be cool.
Absolutely. You know. Yeah, sure.
I know.
You know, if you plant milkweed, you will get so. You know, go to a native nursery, see if you can find some native milkweeds, and if you plant it, they will come. You will get monarch butterflies laying eggs on it. And if you want to take those caterpillars indoors and raise them up and see them turn into butterflies, you can do it.
I know my brother actually lives right near us here in Ocala. He actually has a butterfly garden, and they planted all the plants that butterflies like. And he has. You'll go out there; there'll be 100 butterflies in front of his house at any given time.
Nice, nice. Yeah, that's the nice thing. I mean, the reason that plants have flowers is not, you know, for us. We happen to think they're pretty too, but it's specifically for the bees and the butterflies. So if you take a beautiful butterfly garden or beautiful garden that you like and just tweak it just ever so slightly, plant like big clumps of plants because they're a little bit nearsighted, so having big, you know, patches of color, have plants that bloom early in the year and late in the year and things that are short and tall and you know, have all sorts of different colors. Don't shy away from white flowers and pastels, things like that. Reds, blues, yellows. You will get lots of butterflies and native bees, and it'll be beautiful when there are no butterflies, and it'll be even more beautiful when there are butterflies.
Now, are you located at Animal Kingdom? Is that where your offices are?
Yes, sir. We're lucky enough to be right here, smack dab in the middle of Animal Kingdom. It's awesome.
Now, I'm getting a lot of questions. I'm getting a lot of questions from listeners right now about, and we're waiting for our next guest. I think she's going to be calling in here shortly, Rachel Smith, unless you're handing off to her.
I can hand it right off to her. That's
okay. All right. Well, then I'll ask you this question before you do. So now we're getting lots of questions about the hurricane coming up and about the animal. Mm-hmm. Everybody's worried about the animals at Animal Kingdom. I am assuming that Disney has a hurricane preparedness plan for the animals at Animal Kingdom that's about the size of the Bible. Am I right about that?
No, this is not my area of expertise. I have to tell you, I really focus on the butterflies.
I didn't know if it was all hands on deck for hurricane time.
I have a question for Dr. Gazan. if you have a second, I'm sure, sorry, I dropped off.
But let me just say really, really quick that Disney is phenomenally good at being prepared.
I figured.
And they absolutely have experts that are looking after the animal welfare. So yeah. I just wanted to say that although my focus is on the butterflies, believe me, Disney's on top of it.
Yeah, and you know what? The barns there are made out of concrete block that isn't going anyplace. So,
so yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
So my question was kind of funny. I listened to you and you're a doctor and you're talking so passionately about butterflies. If you're like, you know, at a bar and somebody walks up to you and goes, can I buy you a drink? And you're like, yeah, what do you do? You're like, I'm a doctor. And they're like, sweet. And you're like,
well, you got,
yeah.
You got, yeah.
They're like, what kind of doctor are you? You're like, I'm a doctor of butterflies. Like, how does that work?
Yeah, baby, absolutely. So I don't know if you know this, but the world's biggest entomology conference was just here in Orlando, and there is nothing more nerdy and enthusiastic and beautiful than a group of entomologists together. It is the most incredible, just dork fest you can.
Do they wear shirts awesome. Covered in butterflies? Just tell me they do, please.
Of course they do. Are you kidding me? Absolutely they do.
Oh God, I was.
Yeah, in fact, I bought two shirts for my daughter that are covered in insects. You know? Yes. Yeah. No, we're all about it.
That's
no, I proudly say that I am a doctor of butterflies and bees and all sorts of things.
That is so awesome.
I'll tell you what, though. You're going to learn that Zach is cool, really cool doctor of butterflies. If you go to his website, you're going to see him in the Arctic and all over the world. He's quite an adventurer, too. You would think a doctor of butterflies would just be smoking a pipe and wearing a sweater, but that's not true. If you go to his website, you're going to see a whole different guy. I was very impressed. So,
thank you.
Hot, too, of course, so that helped.
Dr. Gazan, thank you so much
for joining us.
And you got Rachel on coming on next, right? Rachel Smith?
She is right here. Let me pass.
Okay,
let me pass the phone to her.
I want to know what you were about to say.
I'm okay. Thank you so much.
He was about to say something. Cut him off.
Hi, this is Rachel.
Hi, Rachel. How are you today? Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
All right. Well, I mean, Glenn was just talking to Dr. Gazan about the hurricane coming. You are doing a lot of work is where you specialize on Vero Beach. Are they going to be okay?
Are they going to be okay? Yes. Well, let me back up and say for just a second, for those who aren't sort of familiar of how turtly Florida is. We're in one of the hotspots for nesting activity for sea turtles in the entire world. And 90% of all the sea turtle nesting in the U.S. happens in Florida. So as you can imagine, we have hundreds of thousands of nests sometimes in a given year. Disney monitors a stretch of beach along Vero Beach that spans about 5 miles, and we had 1,280 nests this year. So that's an average of about 250 nests per mile. Most of them, luckily, have hatched by the time this hurricane is headed our way, which is great. We only have a handful of nests left on the beach. But we have been down there getting the whole entire beach prepared for hurricane impact. You know, as you know, we're on a hurricane watch down on the southeastern coast of Florida. Mm-hmm. Luckily, we only have a few nests. We are expecting some erosion, but I always like to say that the turtles have been withstanding hurricanes for the last several million years, and they're very resilient to storms such as this one. And so we are expecting not to have huge impacts to the sea turtle populations here as a result of this hurricane.
Well, the sea turtles are such a big part of the beaches in Florida. I've had to tell you, I got married in St. Augustine.
Oh, that's so awesome.
did we lose Jamie? Oh, I think we lost.
She might have disappeared.
I think we lost Jamie. I'll try and get her back. But she did. She got married in St. Augustine on the beach.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and I do know that you guys, I know that all of Florida is aware of the importance of the sea turtles, because even when you go to Daytona Beach and places like that, they really work hard to protect. Is that something that you work on as well? Is it just Vero Beach, or are you guys concerned about the turtle populations, and how are the turtle populations?
Okay, well, several questions there. Let me try to tackle each one. First of all, yes, it's true that our on-the-ground conservation work here with our Disney biologists happens in Vero Beach, but that's not to say that we don't have impacts with sea turtle populations around the state and around the world. The Disney Conservation Fund has, at this point, funded over $2 million worth of worth of funding for sea turtle conservation projects around the world. So we're very dedicated to the fact that we have global populations of sea turtles. All 7 species right now are endangered, including the 3 species that are nesting along Florida's beaches. So while we have our direct conservation work in Vero, we are very mindful of the fact that there are sea turtles nesting all over the place and that they all need protection. Regarding what we do on our beach, we, as I mentioned before, we have a 5-mile stretch of beach that our biologists go out and monitor daily during the nesting season. So we're marking every new nest, we're monitoring it until it hatches, and then we are doing a nest inventory at the end. We're rescuing any hatchlings that need assistance out of the nest at the very end, and we're also collecting important data on reproductive success. So there's a lot of things going on our beach, and we try to get creative with our conservation efforts. One of the most important things I think that we did this year is train a sniffer dog to actually help us locate those freshly laid sea turtle nests.
That's cool.
Okay. And this is there anything cool. Dogs can't sniff out?
Yeah, dogs are busy.
I'm beginning to think that dogs are invincible. And they are our best friend not only in our homes, but also in terms of conservation. Because I'll tell you, great things come in small packages. And this little guy, he's a pocket beagle. His name is Captain Ron. He's only 3 years old, but he is full of potential, both with detecting sea turtle nests and with being just an absolutely great ambassador for sea turtle conservation. And we've been so thrilled with his progress this year.
Yeah, that's incredible. So with his, beagles are obviously, I think, the most sensitive of all the sniffing dogs. What is he sniffing? I mean, what is the difference between just finding a regular egg and sniffing out a sea turtle egg?
That's a great question. And we, at the very beginning of this project, we were trying to figure out how we were going to tackle this problem with training. And what we determined is that he could pick up the scent of the thin mucus coating that surrounds the outside of the turtle egg as it's dropping into the ground as the mother sea turtle is laying those eggs. And so we were able to go out and do some sampling and collect mucus samples that were actually surrounding the turtle eggs, and he was trained on that scent. And that keeps him from not locating every single old nest on the beach from previous years that are decomposing and providing nutrients to the dune sand, but we're only targeting those freshly laid sea turtle nests that we need to stake off for protection and monitor for that season. So he's been at almost 100% accuracy this year.
So Captain Ron, a 3-year-old beagle, can sniff out a layer of mucus that are on eggs that are buried in the sand.
It's phenomenal. And some of these nests are 2 or 3 feet, sometimes 4 feet down in the sand. And we used to spend about 45 minutes finding some of these very difficult to find nests under the sand so that we could put protective stakes around them. He goes out on the beach as if he's just trying to show off, and he finds it in about 10 seconds.
Unbelievable.
And then he sits there and watches us do all the rest of the work marking the nest. It's pretty phenomenal.
Has that helped? So when you mark the nest, that's basically stay away from this spot, right? I mean, that's what we're trying to accomplish,
right,
is keep humans away from that spot. Has it helped? I mean, are humans being respectful is my question.
Yes, and I think the answer to that is a resounding yes. I mean,
we've been talking about so much negative human stuff today with all the other animals that it's good to have a victory here.
I know. It's really great to see how a dog can contribute to conservation in this really creative way. And we're just so excited at the results because, as you were mentioning, it's a federal offense to tamper with sea turtle nests on beaches in Florida. And so the more that we can put those protective stakes around that we find, the better, and the more it keeps them safe on our beaches. And this dog is helping us to do that. So I think it's a true success story and a happy ending story for us.
Do the turtles themselves, which get pretty big, right? I mean, what do they end up weighing as a full-grown grandpa?
First of all, we mostly only have the females coming up and visiting us on the beach. But yes, they get extremely large, you're right. And we have 3 main species that are consistently nesting on our beaches. We have the loggerhead sea turtle, the green turtle, which is the one of Finding Nemo fame, if everybody remembers Crush and Squirt from our Finding Nemo film. And we also have the leatherback sea turtle, and they are sort of living dinosaurs, and they can reach sizes of up to 2,000 pounds.
Whoa! That's one big turtle.
Yeah. It is a very large turtle.
That's the size of those. That's the weight of those draft horses pulling the trolley down Main Street.
Yes, exactly. And when you see their tracks on the beach, they leave us those very conspicuous tracks, and that's how we even know to search the sand for nests in the morning. But when the leatherback leaves those tracks on the beach for us, it looks like a car drove out of the ocean. It's really amazing.
Unbelievable. Wow.
That's just incredible. So what are their predators? What predators does it? I understand what predators the eggs have, okay? But what predators do the full-grown sea turtles have? Sharks? Or are they just too crunchy?
People.
Yeah, so the adult sea turtles are rather large. Even the smallest species on our beach ends up around 250 or 300 pounds as an adult. So they're pretty formidable against most predators in the ocean. Tiger sharks in particular, will sometimes attack adult turtles, but for the most part, really, their only threat at that size are humans. Mm-hmm. And that's not to say that the little hatchlings don't have a myriad of threats as they are leaving our beaches and heading out to the open ocean, but the adults are fairly safe except for impacts from humans.
I got to tell you, Rachel, the most bizarre experience we ever had with large turtles was we were putting on a horse show. This was in Massachusetts. It was early in the morning. We were getting the sand arena ready for the horse show to start at like 9 o'clock. We could not start that horse show till almost 11 because about 20 huge snapping turtles had come into the sand to lay their eggs. And they were not being encouraged to move. So we just sat and waited for them to leave. It was the most bizarre thing I've ever seen.
But pretty cool, right?
Yeah, it was cool. I mean, it was cool, but it was just bizarre to watch because I'd never seen, and I didn't know they all like wanted to do it at the same time. It's like egg laying time. We're going over here, and an email went out and they all showed up. It was just...
Yeah, it's pretty phenomenal that even those aquatic turtles that we have will sort of head out of their pond areas to lay eggs on land. And so it's the same concept as our sea turtles coming out of the ocean to lay eggs on our nesting beaches. But I think it's a really cool thing to watch.
But who knew it was a group activity? I mean, it was like...
Yeah, sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. On our beaches, it's not necessarily a group activity for our species, but there are species of sea turtles, namely the Kemp's Ridley turtle, that will nest in what they call arribadas. And so they're big, giant formations, and all the turtles in the thousands come out of the ocean at one time onto one nesting beach and lay their eggs. And it is one of the great things in nature to be able to witness. It's really cool.
Really neat. So how can people get involved and help? Obviously, besides ordering turtle off a menu, what can people do to help?
Well, first of all, I'd like to just encourage anybody in the area, even if you're not in our area, to come visit us at Disney's Vero Beach Resort. This is home base for us, where the Disney's Animal Science and Environment team, our whole team of sea turtle experts, are down there from April through October, and we offer daily encounters where you can come on the beach and watch us look at sea turtle tracks, inventory sea turtle nests. We have hatchling releases. We have guided sea turtle night walks in June and July, where if you come stay at the resort, you can embark on this great adventure at night to see a sea turtle lay eggs up close and personal under the supervision of trained guides. And so it's a really phenomenal way to connect with nature and to inspire people to take action. And in terms of action, I think the main things that we encourage people to do that people can do anywhere that they live is to keep litter and plastics out of the environment. Because as you know, all waterways lead to the ocean. You don't have to be living on the coast in order to help a sea turtle, because any plastic that gets into a canal or waterway will end up in the ocean where it could harm a sea turtle. Those big leatherbacks that I told you about earlier, their sole diet is jellyfish. And so if they see a plastic bag floating around in the ocean, they will assume it's a jellyfish and it will make them very sick. So aside from donating, one of the main things we can do to help is just really avoid single-use plastics and keep all of that stuff out of the environment for sea turtles.
I like sea turtles even more. They eat jellyfish. That's perfect.
Everybody should love and support turtles.
That's right. That's right, because none of us really like jellyfish all that much when we're swimming in the ocean. So,
although they do have their importance in the ecosystem, too.
Yeah, as long as they stay away from the beach, I'm happy that they have importance in the ocean. No, this has been great. Thank you so much. I have to ask you a question. It's a question we asked earlier. And so what did you tell people when growing up that you wanted to be?
Oh, that's a great question. So I have been a bio nerd ever since I was born. Both of my parents are biologists, so I think it was inevitable that I ended up on this career trajectory. But I was always a shark person growing up, and still now I'm helping to manage the shark work here at Disney as well as the turtle work. And so I've always sort of been into the animals that most people didn't find as fun, like the sharks and all the creepy crawlies that we call, you know, herps, reptiles and amphibians. And so those are the animals I've always focused on. And I'm just so happy that Disney embraces those animals in the same way that they embrace all the other animals here. And we're allowed to have these amazing conservation programs that help all of Earth's creatures, not just the cuddly ones.
You got like your ultimate dream job and you're like 22. I mean, you did. You got your.
I wish I was 22, but yeah.
You got your. You sound like you're 22, but you got your ultimate dream job and ended up doing it at Disney World. How cool is that? That's pretty cool.
It is the coolest. I am so thankful every single day.
I bet.
Turtles and sharks and all, and Disney. I mean, who could ask for anything more?
Yeah, you got a cool, and live in Florida, so that's not too bad either. So there you go. Well, be safe down there at Vero Beach. We know that Disney will be battening down the hatches and that they have some very strong buildings built down there. Thank you so much for joining us, Rachel. We really appreciate it. And thank you to everybody that joined us today. It's been a fun day of learning about all the different creatures around the world that are being helped by Disney World, and we hope that we have enlightened you to things that happen behind the scenes that you don't always see when you end up at Animal Kingdom. You don't see when you're riding the roller coasters, and you don't even think about all the work that's being done for the good of the world and of the animals
and
worldwide.
I think that's what the most interesting part is that this is not, you know, with just starting with our first guest who is involved with the islands above Guam for birds. And then you travel to the Democratic Republic of Congo. And then you move over to another part of Africa where they're studying bees and elephants. And then you go to Florida and California with butterflies and then Vero Beach for turtles. It's just, it is so incredible to think about how Disney is just reaching around the entire world using its power for good. You know, what another takeaway is people are terrible, but there's some really bad people out there, but there's a whole lot more good people who are trying to fix the mistakes of just a couple jerks, you know? So it's really interesting to think about the worldwide reach that Disney is having.
And that all goes back to Walt, as we learned on last year's show. Walt was a huge animal guy. Walt had horses. He loved animals. And this is something that was, and of course, look at the movies, right? I mean, obviously he was a huge animal guy. So,
well, you think of a big corporation making all the money that Disney must make. I mean, gosh. And you know, they're giving $40 million in annual grants since they started the Disney Conservation Fund. So like I said, that's using your power for good.
Well, we appreciate everybody that came on today. Thank you so much to Robin, who is the zoologist over at the horse side over at Fort Wilderness. And, you know, we also really, really appreciate Stephanie Shook, who is, her title is Disney Animal Science and Environment Engagement and Communication. There's another cool job, too. You get to talk about all the animals and promote them. And Stephanie, you did a great job. Thank you so much for putting this together for us. And we hope that we get to do it in person next year. We'll make our way over to Animal Kingdom and we'll do it in person next year. That'll be a lot of fun too. We hope you enjoyed our second annual Disney. We will be back tomorrow. It is Draft Horse Day here on Horses in the Morning. And then Friday, Jamie will be back and Really Bad Ads will be back. We promise. We promise we'll have some Really Bad Ads back. Get your ads in.
As long as you don't lose internet because of a hurricane.
Yeah, that little thing
called
Matthew.
Careful
promising. You know, every Matthew I knew in high school was a bully too, by the way. So, yeah. So it's just living
Matthews,
up to
Matthews, I knew
sake.
Were weenies. So
oh,
it's
really?
Fine.
And you were going to be good?
Fine. Yeah.
It's going to be it's going to be a category one by the time it reaches us instead of a four.
I don't even know any Matthews.
I did. And they were all bullies. So thank you, everybody. We'll talk to you again tomorrow, hopefully, here at Horses in the Morning.
Bye-bye. All right, everybody. It's been Nutrifield. Hakuna Matata. Yulie. Hafa Adadai.
You were close, I think.
Papa,
Lean-to.